Today on the podcast,
pirates!
Welcome to the Grand Hill Chronicles podcast. My name is Don Bishop, and I write as T.S. Pedramon. And today I have a very special guest. My series is Nightshade Unicorn. I'm actually interviewing a unicorn today. Sometimes it is said. This is Chief Warrant Officer 5, retired, Robert Jacob, who served a good long time in the United States Marine Corps.
All right, I'm going to pause myself right there, and I'm going to let me finish. But, to explain, in the Marine Corps and in the other military branches, there are enlisted personnel and there are officers. Most people have heard of this. What fewer people have heard of, if you're not in the military, is something about warrant officers. A warrant officer is somebody who came from enlisted. You know, the regular officers can come from enlisted, but all the warrant officers, at least in the Marine Corps, came from the enlisted ranks, and they went through some application process that showed that they had a high level of job proficiency in order to receive a warrant to receive a warrant officer commission. And in the Marine Corps band field, all of the officers in charge of the bands for the fleet bands, not the president's own, not the commandant's own, those are separate, those are different. But for the fleet bands, they are led by warrant officers. Now, as a warrant officer is promoted, he or she will be promoted to a Chief Warrant Officer 2, Chief Warrant Officer 3, and so on, all the way to a maximum of a Chief Warrant Officer 5. Now, warrant officers themselves are rare enough, and as you get higher in rank, you get that because you've had the time in the service, and you've had enough time to be able to acquire that rank. And also, likewise, just because of rank structure within an occupational field, Chief Warrant Officer 5s are very rare, and in fact, the Marine Corps staffs one musician, Chief Warrant Officer 5, if I recall. Nope, maybe it's two. Anyway, it's a very small number, right? One or two of them. And so a Chief Warrant Officer 5 is very rare. Thus, they're sometimes called unicorns. So that's the explanation. But also, I need to share a few announcements with you. Before we go on. Now, I mentioned last week about the promotions I was going to be running with Written Word Media, and they interface with several different promotional tools. And so that went live, and in preparation for that, as I told you last week, I already set the ebook price at 99 cents. And again, as I told you last week, I am participating in another promotion on the 23rd, which is just a few days away, where I'm just giving away the ebook for those who find out about Stuff Your Kindle Edition, Stuff Your Kindle Fantasy Edition. So tell your friends. The podcast is the one channel that I'm really announcing this through, that the ebook is free, apart from within the Stuff Your Kindle Fantasy Edition channels or community. And also something I'm doing on the side where I am part of a fantasy readers and writers group online, and we're doing a summer reading challenge, and I'm giving my book to them so that some of them can read it, because I'm going to read some of theirs and they're giving their books to me. Anyway, so all that is to say that yesterday was my highest volume, my highest sales volume day thus far on, well, anywhere, right? And we're talking number of books or ebooks, and it's still a very small number in the field, right? I need to pump these numbers up if I'm going to be able to make a living off of this, which I do hope to do. Yesterday, 34 people bought my ebook. Like, they paid money. They didn't pay a lot of money because it was priced at 99 cents. And, you know, in order to be able to price it at that point, I had to agree to a royalty share of 35%. So I made $11.89 yesterday. But that means 34 people have my book. They were willing to pay a little bit of money to acquire it. That means more exposure, hopefully more reviews, which in turn means more exposure. And today I participated in another one of Written Word Media's promotional tools. And this one wasn't as big. At the time of recording this right now, that is at 10. And it's almost 9 p.m. So it's a much smaller than yesterday's, much smaller audience, I think, is what it got in front of. But yeah, like, this is kind of exciting to see some numbers pump up and my sales ranking in the Kindle store is 18,512 in the entire Kindle store. And that's 174 in Coming of Age Fantasy, number 206 in Action and Adventure Fantasy. They don't have a... Do they not have an Epic Fantasy? Maybe I'm just too low in Epic Fantasy for it to count. I need to look at my keywords again and categories. But if there is an Epic, I really should be there. But anyway, you know, if when you upload your book to Amazon, to KDP, and you publish it, and you, like, sell one book, your sales rank is probably going to be 500,000. And that, you know, that's just a blip. So to be 18,512 is something, you know, that's getting somewhere. Now, I am facing the very real prospect of that number falling right back down once these promotions are over. By the way, the sales did pick up a little bit once I set my price to 99 cents before the promotions began. I just set it on sale and some people noticed and I started getting some small numbers of sales. But anyway, yeah, I'm hoping that this will catch the algorithm. And so I'm telling you to tell your friends that this book exists and it's on sale through next Tuesday, the 25th. If they're not going to pay 99 cents, then they can get it for free via the link in the show notes for the Stuff Your Kindle Fantasy Edition. And that link will be valid. Again, just the same as the 99 cent price. It's going to be dead after the 25th. It'll be good through next Tuesday. So you got to act fast. And, beyond that, I'm a little under the weather right now, but I'm prepping my old house for sale. I finished the kitchen floor shoe molding today, and so that the kitchen just needs to be cleaned up and emptied. The deck also I pretty much finished today, resurfacing the deck. I need to do a couple of touch-ups tomorrow. And then we are emptying the house. We have furniture in there because we were doing some renting out. And so the house is furnished and we need to empty the house so we can put it on the market as quickly as possible. And that's what's going on for now. I will be out of pocket in the middle of July, but I already have episodes recorded. I'm kind of down one right now, so I'm catching up so that I can schedule these ahead of time. You won't know that I'm gone, except my announcements will sound different, and you'll still get these interviews. And then through August, interviews will keep coming. I have
more interviews scheduled, and I'll actually be gone for a couple of weeks in August, but again, the interviews will continue week after week, and we'll have some really good interviews. Today, I am really excited to bring you this interview about pirates. I thought it was really interesting. I really appreciated Chief Warrant Officer 5, retired Jacob's pirate getup that he voluntarily wore for this video call, for this interview. And I think you should go check out his books. I think they sound really interesting. I want to know more about the seafaring culture, because I think a lot of this isn't necessarily pirate culture. Well, you know, I'll let you listen to the interview. I think a lot of it is really interesting, and it's gonna be reflected somewhat in Nightshade Unicorn, because we have some seafaring travels coming up, and I think that is it. Just for history's sake, the interview was recorded on May, 23rd of this year, and these announcements are the night before. It is June 19th. It is Juneteenth. That is a day to remember. I grew up in Texas, so Juneteenth was always a thing. Of course, I was a kid growing up, and so it wasn't like you got off of work, because there wasn't work, and it was the summertime, so you were out of school anyway. But they talked about it, and I am really glad that we abolished slavery in this country. And now I know some people are still kind of wage slaves. I've been there, and I'm still, you know, that's not completely gone. I'm not a wage slave now, I guess, because I am I have the freedom to venture out and try something new. But I do feel that the weight of the need to provide for my family. And anyway, I am so glad that we abolished slavery in this country, and that there may be some qualifiers on that we abolished legal slavery. There are still bad actors out there. There are people who do bad things to each other. And one day Christ will come and all that will end. But for now, we do the best we can to help each other out. So you're listening to this on June 20th. So I'm sorry I'm a day late, but happy Juneteenth. And let's remember what people did and the efforts that they went to make sure that this could be a safe and fair country for everyone. I know there are a lot of unfair things that happen still, but we're always trying to make it better. And enjoy this interview with our pirate expert, Chief Warrant Officer 5, retired, the Unicorn, Robert Jacob. And now he writes about pirates. In nonfiction, he writes real-life accounts, compiles the histories. But before we jump into that, a little bit about SEAWO, as some people say in the Marine Corps. But the Mr. Jacob, so he had a good long career in the Marine Corps, and I'm reading off some of the notes he sent me, even though I actually met him while we were both on active duty. I reported into him as a basic student at the Naval School of Music. He was already a Chief Warrant Officer 5 at that time. So he was in his sunset tour, and I was not yet in my first permanent duty station. But I guess, you know what, let's jump into it. But he had a good long career, and now he writes about pirates, real accounts, and he has been inducted into the International Pirate Hall of Fame. They only take 10 people a year, and that includes Johnny Depp and Earl Flynn. So it's a pretty exclusive club. Now, I still want to call you sir. why don't you tell us a little bit about your Marine Corps career? Like, how did it start out, and kind of the large trajectory through it?
Well, briefly, because I think we're here more to talk about my pirate books than my Marine Corps career. But I was a high school band director, got my master's degree in orchestral conducting, but always wanted to be in the Marines. So I joined the Marine Reserve. I was a forward artillery observer while I was teaching high school and completing my master's degree. And then when my master's degree was over, I augmented to the active force, came in as a Lance Corporal percussionist, worked my way up through the ranks to Staff Sergeant, then to Chief Warrant Officer. And after 31 years, I retired a Chief Warrant Officer 5. My last post was as Commanding Officer of the Marine Corps Detachment at the Armed Forces School of Music, or the Navy School of Music, where I met young Lance Corporal Bishop, who was one of my Marines checking in around, was it 2012 when you checked in?
2012.
Right. Yep. So that was a year before my retirement. But really, the entire time I was in the Marine Corps, I still did living history as a hobby. I got into reenacting in 1971 when I was in high school, and I did French and Indian War and Bicentennial reenacting all through, or Revolutionary War reenacting all through the Bicentennial. And then joined the Marine Corps in 81, and as I got higher up in rank, I had the time to go back to reenacting on the weekends. And I did. I did Rev War reenacting when I was stationed at Cherry Point. In California, I got into Mountain Man Rendezvous reenacting, Western Gunfighter reenacting, and then eventually that led me to pirate reenacting, because after Pirates of the Caribbean came out, all of these pirate reenactment groups sprung up. And I thought that sounded like fun. And when I joined these groups, I immediately realized that all of the books written about pirates were grossly inadequate. They were very inaccurate. They were all rehashes of one book that was written 300 years ago. And the guy was writing a bestseller. He wasn't writing a history book. So I decided to write my own, to tell the true history of the Pirates of the Golden Age. And this all started while I was commanding officer at the School of Music. So you see this long blonde hair that I'm wearing right now? I hate to disappoint your listeners, but it's a wig. I still pretty much keep Marine Corps regulation haircuts. And I wore this wig in 2006 while I was the commanding officer at the School of Music and doing pirate reenactments on the side. So my first book, A Pirate's Life in the Golden Age of Piracy, came out in 2018, followed by Pirates of the Florida Coast, Truths, Legends, and Myths. And my latest book is the full, complete, and true account of Blackbeard the Pirate. And that will be out in just a few weeks.
Yeah, and maybe we could even time this episode to come around the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a question. So you have, tell us again the titles of those three books.
The first one is A Pirate's Life in the Golden Age of Piracy. The second one is Pirates of the Florida Coast, Truths, Legends, and Myths. And the third is Blackbeard, The Truth Revealed.
They sound really interesting. Now, what was the Golden Age of Piracy?
There's a lot of debate over that because the any Golden Age is when all of the main things happen and the traditions develop. Let me do an analogy. The Golden Age of Television. When did the Golden Age of Television start? I'll tell you when it finished for me was when they canceled Star Trek. To me, when Star Trek went off the air in 1969, that was the end of the Golden Age of Television. And ever since, it's just been rehashes. How many times do they play the Andy Griffith Show or Gilligan's Island in reruns? It's constant. The Beverly Hillbillies. That was the Golden Age of Television. The Golden Age of Piracy starts in the Caribbean in 1625 with the rise of the buccaneers on Hispaniola. And I end the Golden Age of Piracy in 1722 with the death of John Roberts. He was the last of the great pirates. And after John Roberts was killed, the public perception of pirates had changed. They were no longer tolerated by governments. They were exterminated.
Okay. That brings up some interesting questions. And on kind of on the side, since the golden age of piracy, have you seen the show One Piece, whether anime or the live action?
No, I haven't.
There's a show.
I haven't.
I guess it started as a manga or a comic book.
Hmm.
I'm not into any manga myself, but and then there's an anime which actually started in 1999, I think. Or maybe that was the first English translation. I don't know. But this year, Netflix produced a live-action series of One Piece. And I didn't come on here to talk about One Piece, but it's interesting because One Piece and Pirates of the Caribbean, they both raise, in my mind, questions about people's acceptance of pirates. You know, and the question of the meaning of and the morality of being a pirate. And in Muppet Treasure Island, I believe it was, where what's his name? The actor who played Long John Silver. Anyway, he says that, yeah, it was definitely Muppet Treasure Island because it was in a song. The English and the French have very different views of this one particular pirate, you know, that where the, I think the French hate him and the English idolize him. So what can we talk about that really? Kind of a, oh, and as far as One Piece, they call it the Great Pirate Era. And I suspected, and I looked it up, but I forgot what the answer was, that the word for pirate in Japanese translates more into like a seafaring clan, something like that. And so they're, I can see room in that translation for innocuous pirates, you know, where they're pirates because they're a clan, they're seafaring and kind of like that. Not familial clan, but a group traveling together and throwing their fortunes together and not necessarily plundering and murdering, etc. And then there's Pirates of the Caribbean. There's the moral grayness of Captain Jack Sparrow, where like he is out to steal and he's all about number one, but then just for, I guess, for plot reasons, the main character Will Turner sees Jack Sparrow as a good man, you know, and there are some redeeming qualities in that character as well, like he liberated his load of slaves instead of selling them into continued slavery. So I was going to let you talk. I'm sorry I didn't. So let's, why don't we talk about the morality or acceptance of pirates in different times?
Certainly. Well, first we've got to get the definition clear. What exactly is a pirate? Technically, what makes one pirate according to British statutory law is one who commits crimes at sea. So if I rob a stagecoach on a road, I am a road agent or a thief. If I take a ship at sea, now I'm a pirate. Now that gets kind of complicated because what if I'm a pirate at sea, but then we land and take a city from the landward side, like the Vikings did? Well, technically, you're still a pirate because you came from the sea, even though your crimes were committed on land.
Mm-hmm.
Now the second point is a privateer versus a pirate. A privateer is a legal pirate. They have letters of marque issued by a governor or an official authorized by a governor to attack ships listed in those letters of marque. So when England was on unfriendly terms with the Spanish, they would issue letters of marque to allow people to take Spanish ships. And the deal was 25% of your take went back to the government. Now, this was pretty standard in the 17th and early 18th century. Countries had...
I'm aware that even privateers even played a significant role in World War I. And World War II, I'm not aware of. But in World War I, I know that they did.
Well, yeah. It's and like in the 17th and 18th centuries, countries had very small navies. So when they went to war, they had to immediately augment that naval force. And they did it with privateers. Privateers were looked upon as national heroes. Now, this is something interesting. Of course, everyone's heard of John Paul Jones, the father of the United States Navy. and his most famous naval engagement was when he took the HMS Serapis. But when he did that, he was a privateer working for the French. There was no commission for him in the U.S. Navy, so he went to France and got letters of marque from the King of France, and he was actually sailing as a privateer in that famous engagement.
Okay.
So a lot of times, pirates drifted back and forth between being a privateer and being a pirate. If there were no letters of marque available, then you became a pirate to fill in until there was another war, and then you could get letters of marque. Up until 1720, it was common for a king to issue a blanket pardon for all of the piracy crimes when he was about to go to war, so that he could turn all those pirates into privateers. So there was a certain acceptance. Yes, if we catch them, we might hang them, but we're really not going to go after pirates too hard because we might need them 6 months later when we go to war with Spain or France.
Interesting.
And a lot of times the pirates themselves were looked upon more as folk heroes, closer to Robin Hood, robbing people fighting the Sheriff of Nottingham. Because the governments were so corrupt and so evil, the pirates leveled the playing field for the common man. Which is another reason why characters like Johnny Depp become folk heroes. Because to them, yeah, he's robbing people, but he's not really killing anyone. And he's robbing primarily the government agents and big industry that is aligned with the government officials. And then you get people like Blackbeard, who turned to piracy for political reasons. Blackbeard was part of what they call the Jacobite Revolution. England went into a civil war in 1715 when King George became King of England, because half of the country thought it should be James Edward Stuart, who was the son of the former king. But he was barred from being king because he was Catholic. So they selected George, who was from Germany, didn't speak English, had never been to England, but now he was King of England. And there was a huge civil war. And Blackbeard was part of that civil war, fighting for the Jacobite cause, and garnished a great deal of support from locals because he was actually fighting on their side.
Wow. That's... Yeah. And it's kind of interesting. Like, do you know how he came about to just be called Blackbeard? I imagine he had a black beard, but why did people start using that moniker instead of his name?
Well, they did kind of evenly. The very first reference to him by name as a pirate came in 1716. Now, his name officially in the record was Taitch. It would have been pronounced Taitch or Tatch, depending on the accent of the region you're from. In most of the official English reports, it's spelled T-H-A-T-C-H. The Boston Newsletter spells it T-E-A-C-H, which is why everybody calls him Edward Teach. Leave it to the newspaper to spell your name wrong. At any rate, his name Blackbeard appeared very early in the record, just shortly after that in 1717. No one knows how he got that name. And there's a kind of an interesting theory out there that you could read about in my book. One of the theories is perhaps his last name wasn't Tatch, but it was Beard, Edward Beard. And a lot of times pirates got the name Black Sam Bellamy, Black Bart. And he went by the name of Black Beard and thought, would it be a cute idea if I grew a beard to go with my name?
Yeah. So was the nickname like Black for pirates? Is that to go with their, is that to cast shade on the character?
Yes. But among the men themselves, like Black Bart and Black Sam Bellamy, they loved the nickname because it made them fierce. And being fierce is good for a pirate because that means that your prize crew is going to surrender without a fight and you don't have to kill anybody.
Just easy money. Yep.
But there's no question that he had this huge black beard, which was very unusual for the time. In 1715 to 1718, everyone was clean shaven.
Okay. I didn't know that. Yeah, I'm seeing images of him on Wikipedia and this nice large beard.
Yes. Everyone describes him as having that large beard. In fact, the Lieutenant Robert Maynard, who is the man that actually killed Blackbeard, described his long beard with ribbons, you know, kind of like a braided beard, and all of the braids were tied up with ribbons.
Interesting. Yeah, this is all fascinating stuff. So, what pulled you toward pirates? And I guess you lightly touched on it earlier. Was it just the reenactments? Like, can you, I don't know, just go into that a little bit more?
Well,
like why pirates? Why not civil war reenactment? Or,
well, as I said, I had done a wide variety of reenactments, and up until 2003, I had never considered pirate reenacting as something that interested me. Of course, I loved pirates like every kid. I played Treasure Island when I was 10 years old in the backyard, and just like everybody. But my interest in pirates was not unusual. That changed with Pirates of the Caribbean. And that movie changed a lot of reenactments. After that movie came out, in the summer of 2003, pirate groups started springing up everywhere. And the movie was so fascinating, and it just captured the imagination of the world, that it drew me into pirate reenacting.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was a pretty fascinating movie too. What else was I gonna, yeah, I didn't know that there were pirate reenactment groups. I knew that the other reenactment groups existed. I actually found out about that through another musician, who left the School of Music right before I arrived, I think. But we wound up in the same duty station after that. And he talked about doing Civil War reenactments. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of my introduction to knowing that it happens. And now there are, not re, but there are, I guess, fictional enactments of different things. Like I went to a little Comic-Con type event at a local library last weekend. And, you know, I was there selling my book, and there were some other authors there, and there were some LARPers there. And, my daughter got to see their demonstration, and she's just really intrigued by that. And now I think sometime next month, we're going to have to go and see how LARPing happens and that. But, yeah, I didn't know that there were pirate reenactments.
Up until 2003, there were very few. And normally those groups were centered around cities that actually had experienced pirate attacks, mainly Charleston, South Carolina, and St. Augustine. St. Augustine was destroyed by a pirate attack in 1668. So they would reenact that pirate invasion every year on the anniversary, which just so happened to be close to Memorial Day. So it's a great 3-day weekend with a pirate invasion. And a few other cities had some association with pirates. But after 2003, I was stationed at 29 Palms, California, which is in the middle of the Mojave Desert. And we started seeing pirate groups in Palm Springs. Well, I can pretty confidently say that there was no pirate activity in the Mojave Desert.
But yeah.
Suddenly, yeah, you have pirate groups all over California. And that's what drew me into it.
Fascinating. And oh, what was I gonna, sorry, I have questions, they get jumbled up in my mind and I forget them. So how do they do these reenactments in the desert or whatever the case may be? Do they just draw out where a ship is supposed to be? And
no, what most pirate events are is a living history camp. Your pirate reenactors will set up a camp with authentic tents and tables, and they'll do generic educational discussions for the public, like how do the weapons work? What were their tactics? A cooking demonstration. What food did they eat? How did they make food on ship? How do they make food on shore? And they might have a couple of little skits. One of the pirate groups I was in, we always had a couple of skits where we would wind up arguing about something and dueling on the beach, so to speak. But a lot of it is geared towards getting small children involved in doing something fun and educating the public about a way of life.
What are some surprising things about that way of life? Something that surprised you or something just really you would not expect?
Interesting question. Well, one of the things before I got into history that I did not consider was life ashore. When you're in this imaginary world of pirates as a kid or even watching Pirates of the Caribbean, everything takes place on the ship. But that wasn't true. A ship has to be careened about once every 4 or 5 months. Now, what is careening? They actually have to drag the entire ship up onto the beach, which I have no idea how they did it, but they all did. You find some secluded spot, drag the entire ship up, and clean the hull. Because a ship in warm water gets filled with barnacles and seaweed and worms that will bore into the wood. Now, the barnacles and seaweed slows the ship down tremendously. Slow and pirate is bad.
Yeah.
But worse, the worms will work their way into the wood and your ship will literally disintegrate. So you've got to careen the ship, drag it up, scrape the hull, and treat it with a mixture of sulfur and tar that waterproofs it and kills the worms. Then you've got to put it in the water, turn it around, drag it up, and treat the other side. Well, where do the pirates live while their ship is being careened? They set up camp on the beach. And this is where all the pirate encampments are replicating this beach life, which would have represented about a quarter of their time.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I knew that barnacles happened and they had to scrape them off. Yeah. I wouldn't have thought every 4 or 5 months. I would have thought, or did you say 3 or 4 months?
Sometimes.
I would have thought it less frequently.
Yeah, it depends on the temperature of the water. The warmer the water, the worse it gets. So pirates that were operating north of Virginia, maybe once every 7 or 8 months. Pirates that are in the Caribbean all the time, once every 4 or 5 months. Or they could take the easy way and just steal a new ship.
Yeah. And like I said in my email, this is actually more relevant to me than I expected, because in the Nightshade Unicorn series, there's only one book out yet, but I'm working on book two, and there is seafaring that happens. There is a little bit in the first book in the prologue, and in the epilogue, they're getting ready for another one. But in book two, there's a seafaring voyage that happens, like the main character is going to be on a boat. And so I haven't decided everything. My outline isn't very precise beyond where I am so far. So there might be pirates. I haven't decided whether there should or shouldn't be. But this is interesting. Like this detail of warm waters, you got to de-barnacle more often.
And there's also another interesting fact. Of course, you could find some secluded beach somewhere in the Bahamas and careen your vessel. But then what do you eat and what do you drink? You've got to be well supplied ahead of time. There were a few communities that capitalized on this need and became pirate-friendly areas where pirates could go to careen. One of those was Accomack, Virginia, on the Atlantic side of the eastern shore, just before you get to the Maryland border. Pirates would go there and could careen in safety. The locals would sell them food, rum, whatever they wanted. It was a terrific way for the locals to make a lot of money, bring it into the economy, and they kept their mouths shut so the pirates wouldn't have to worry about the authorities.
So is it something that we know about now because it's long after the fact? And at the time, it was just kind of hush-hush between the pirates. They told each other and the the authorities didn't know, or the authorities maybe allowed some areas to do this?
It's an interesting question. They certainly knew about it in 1698 because a pirate named William Dampier wrote about it in a book. William Dampier was a very successful pirate that made a round-the-world voyage. He was not a captain. He was just a member of the crew. And his vessel careened at Accomack, Virginia, wound up sailing around the world. He got tired of the pirate life and left it and went back to England and wrote a best-selling book describing his round-the-world voyage. Now, one might think that if you're a pirate and you admit to all of these acts of piracy in print, that you might be arrested. But he was also the first person to describe the Galapagos Islands, the first person to describe Australia. And in addition to mentioning all of these piratical deeds, he described the flora and fauna very accurately. So his book became the number one bestseller in Great Britain. He started doing lectures at the National Geographic Society, and the Royal Navy commissioned him as a captain and sent him back to continue the work.
Wow.
And he wrote all about careening at Accomack back then, but no one seemed to do anything about it because Blackbeard careened there 20 years later.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. That's like, yeah. It reminds me of when I was in, yeah, I don't want to get into it, but if you tell somebody about a problem and then they still suffer from it later, it's their own fault. It's like the authorities at that time, if they didn't like piracy, why didn't they do anything about it? But
well, you also maybe have they, to consider the resources. The Royal Navy only had three warships stationed in the entire continent of North America to defend the colonies. And they had one in New York, they had one in Barbados, and they had one in Virginia. And to leave their station would have left that city unprotected against a full onslaught of pirate attacks from a unfriendly country.
Okay, wow. So kind of a question of resources.
Right.
Lack of resources. Yeah. Well, what's I'm just thinking about what about different countries? You've kind of talked about pirates in the Caribbean and between England, the States, and France, and a little bit of Spain. Is there anything kind of off the wall, large pirate activity in other waters or in other realms?
Yes. I write in my book, the first ship ever built was probably a merchant ship. The second ship ever built was probably a pirate ship. So you've got pirates literally everywhere. If there's water, there's pirates. Now, my book focused primarily on the pirates that grew out of the Caribbean because they are the ones that most impact the United States and English colonies. The French had just as many privateers and pirates as the English did. We just don't know about them as much because, well, first, and I'd actually have to say there were more English pirates than there were French pirates, especially at that time. Now, the Spanish were a little bit different because for them, everybody was a privateer. They didn't have pirates per se. They were all privateers. They were all sanctioned by the Spanish government. So their pirate force acted a lot more just like a regular naval force than the traditional pirate. And that was true up until 1821. But then, of course, you've got lots of pirates in the Mediterranean, maybe mostly Arabian pirates, the Barbary Coast and the Barbary pirates. Mm-hmm. And then the Indian Ocean was filled with Chinese pirates and pirates from Sumatra and just about everywhere else.
Okay. Yeah, this is really interesting stuff. You mentioned the Barbary pirates, and I'm like, yes, of course. You know, that's Marine Corps history right there. We both know that. From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, right. Like, hello, right there. That was why. So piracy. It's really interesting how there are different flavors of piracy. Like, there's the obviously up to no good. And then there's the political differences, and somebody's actually kind of protesting or taking action against a regime. Mm-hmm. And then there's, not partisan, but nationalistic, where endorsed by one government and demonized by another. Now, what about another common thread, music? Is there anything interesting between pirates and music, or maybe just perhaps seafaring folk?
No, there certainly is. Music, of course, was a big part of life at sea because it's boring. So if you could have some entertainment, that's all the better. But there was one pirate, John Roberts, who took it to the next level. Every time he took a ship, if you were a musician, you were forced to join the crew. Generally, when a pirate in the 1715, 1720 time period, when they would capture another ship, they would ask for volunteers. If you wanted to join, great. If you didn't want to join, you weren't forced, unless you were a surgeon, a carpenter, or a musician. They were so valuable that they were forced into service. Now, John Roberts would have his band up on the quarterdeck playing during an attack. In fact, victims say they knew when the broadside was about to begin because they heard the band strike up a tune. Mm.
That is, you said he took it up a notch, and he certainly did. Mm-hmm. So were there any distinctive instruments that they would use on ship, or would it be just the whatever instruments existed at the time?
Whatever instruments existed at the time, certainly one of the main instruments would have been violin. There were violins everywhere. Every ship had somebody that could play a violin. There were a few woodwind instruments. There certainly were some 18th century clarinets and some flutes. Tin whistles were very, very common. There were a lot of tin whistles, which provided most of your woodwind sound. And there were some small stringed instruments, like little guitars called cavaquinhos, which were invented by the Portuguese and eventually developed into the ukulele. There were some lutes. Lutes were also very popular during that time period. Guitars were only popular in Spain. You didn't see guitars in England, but you did see lute guitars, which has the body of a lute but the neck of a guitar, which was very popular during the golden age of piracy.
And what about percussion? They just have kind of a bass and a snare?
Percussion would have been more like small handheld drums, similar to what you see in Irish bands, with a little spoon-type thing and little instruments that go click, click. But if you look at a lot of modern Irish bands, that's probably the closest you're going to get to original pirate music. A tin whistle, a violin, and some percussion.
Okay. I'm taking notes here because this is a lot of this is material I would like to factor into when I have my characters on ship, you know?
Well, this is all included in my first book. In fact, the last section of my first book, after I complete the history of pirates, I go into how pirates lived. What was their music like? What were their weapons like? Tactics? How did they dress? What did they drink? Most people are surprised to find that the most common drink among pirates was hot chocolate.
I am surprised right now. I did not expect that. So I saw a meme or something going around the internet that followed a ship. I don't remember what ship it was during the American Revolution, where they loaded up in port before they left to go do some seafaring war, and it follows like how much alcohol they brought on and how much water, you know, and it's like, there's all this alcohol and then they go into another port and they take in all this more alcohol.
I know the story that you're talking about. It was supposedly the USS Constitution.
Yeah. That's what I thought.
Yeah. That story has been debunked. That was actually invented sometime in the 1970s and was circulated around the reenactment groups, and everybody read it. And, I used to read it on Marine birthday every year as a motivational speech to my Marines, but it's loosely based on historical fact, but not completely.
Yeah. Well, and they would have used alcohol as a clean drink, like water, standing water is not a great thing to have around if you can't clean
it. Well, let me tell you about grog. You may have heard of the term grog, but you probably don't know really what it is.
I think I have encountered, but I don't remember.
You've encountered what it's become in the 20th and 21st century as some kind of nasty drink.
I've heard the story though, but it is fascinating. So, and I don't
remember. The English used to serve rum on all of their ships. They started serving that in the 1670s, and the water was very unsanitary. So if you drank the water, you got dysentery. If you didn't drink the water, you got dehydrated. And if you only drank rum, then you got drunk and dehydrated. So the Royal Navy had a real serious problem. And one of their admirals, a man named Edward Vernon, who had the nickname of Old Grog, came up with a solution. So why did he have the nickname Old Grog? Well, he made his uniform out of grogram wool. Grogram wool is a cheap kind of common man coarse wool. And the average sailor just did not expect an admiral to make his uniform out of grogram wool. Well, because he did, that endeared him to his men. He's one of the guys. His uniform is made out of the same stuff as ours. So he got the nickname Old Grog. Well, he solved this problem by adding rum to the water. He didn't know it, but the alcohol was purifying the water, which means you're not going to get dysentery anymore. And it cut the alcohol, so you're not going to get as drunk, but it still tasted really nasty. So he decided to flavor it with brown sugar and lime juice. Now, he didn't know it at the time, but the lime juice prevented his men from getting scurvy. So Admiral Vernon's crews were healthier than any of the other crews in the Royal Navy. And pretty soon, the drink grog, which is basically rum, water, brown sugar, and lime juice, began to be served on all Royal Naval vessels. Now, an interesting subnote, a young Lawrence Washington was a member of the Royal Marines aboard Admiral Vernon's ship, and so loved the admiral that he named his plantation Mount Vernon after him. And of course, his brother was George Washington.
Hmm. I did not know that connection. And for listeners or viewers on YouTube who are unaware, in the Marine Corps, there is a tradition called mess night. And you get together and you get dressed up all formal, and it's the evening is very structured and it's very formal in that sense, but then you make fun of all your formalities, and a lot of Marines get drunk. I don't drink, so I didn't get drunk, but that's kind of part of the fun of the evening. And they'll open up the floor for trying to get each other in trouble, and they call it for fines. And so I call up my buddy I stand up and I address the vice president of the mess, and I request permission to address the president of the mess. And if the Mr. Vice gives permission, then I address the president of the mess, and I request permission to address the mess and move about freely. And then I'll make my accusation that something ridiculous, maybe somebody sneezed in formation and something ridiculous. Try to get him in trouble. And if the president of the mess decides that, yes, you committed a crime, then we're going to fine you. And now you have to go and drink the grog. And we make the grog intentionally nasty. Like they'll put some beef into the grog and lots of hot sauce and just make it something that's not tasty at all. So it's
that's a late 20th, more of a 21st century thing, where it kind of And actually started, the Navy started doing that before the Marine Corps did. And then the Marines kind of followed suit.
Yeah. But it's fun and games.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. Do you have anything else for us at this time or anything else you want to share about?
No, I do have a website. So if you want to see where I'm going to be, I do a lot of pirate festivals, speaking engagements, book signings. So that schedule is on my website as well as my books. It's www.robertjacobauthor.com. And you can also email me directly through my website. I respond to every single email I get or any website request. And you can order books directly from me. You can get them from Amazon, but they won't be signed personalized copies. Mm-hmm. You can get a signed personalized copy directly from me if you contact me.
Great. And again, that's robertjacobauthor.com. I'll put that link in the show notes.
Great. Thanks.
And also for any other authors who may be listening, Mr. Jacob is currently the president of the Florida Authors and Publishers Association.
That is correct. We have a book awards contest. It's over now, but for next year, you don't have to live in Florida to enter. In fact, we had a winner from Taiwan last year and winners from Australia and the Netherlands, everywhere. So if you go to the Florida Authors and Publishers Association, their book awards contest starts in October and runs through April. Enter your book. Maybe you'll get an award.
Thank you. And that, what's the URL for that?
Well, you can look up myfapa.org.
There it is.
Yep. Yeah, MYFAPA.
Yep.
Because we used to be fapa.org. But that was some agricultural something or other, and it would take you to a website that had nothing to do with the publishing. So we added the my in front of it to separate it out.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, thank you for coming on. This has been a really fascinating conversation. When does your third book come out? When does your next book come out?
It is finished now. So I'm going to send request to the printers. It normally takes about 3 to 4 weeks for them to send me copies. It will be officially released on August 1st at Kindle and EPUB and on Amazon. But you can get some advanced copies from me probably in about a month.
Okay. So any listeners, I'm not sure exactly what date I'm going to publish this episode yet. We'll talk about that in a minute after I stop the recording. But as we're talking right now, it's May 23rd, 2024. So
mid-June. You can get them probably directly from me anytime mid to late June.
Perfect. All right. Well, thank you again for coming on. And for listeners, we'll see you next week.
Hoorah! Semper Fi, Devil Dog!
Semper Fi.